All right, welcome to Saved by the 90s, a show dedicated to 90s and early 2000s millennial nostalgia. Today on the show, we're going to talk about a couple cartoons that you may remember from your past, Pepper Ann and Kim Possible.
Saved by the 90s!
So let's welcome to the show today our two guests, Madeline Paxson and Eddie Guzalian, who worked as story editors and writers on those shows I just mentioned, Pepper Ann and Kim Possible. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Hi, Tyler.
Hi, thanks for joining us. So you guys have had long, flourishing careers in cartoons. You've gone on to be directors and producers of all sorts of movies, but the 90s and early 2000s treated you well as kind of the beginning of your artistic careers in cartoons. So first of all, I think we should start where each of those shows start, and the audience would be thrilled, I think, to hear the theme songs that they remember from about 20 years ago.
Absolutely.
So let me play just a minute here of the Pepper Ann theme song to start, because for whatever reason, I still sing this like on a daily basis. So here you go.
Who's that girl? What's her name? Is she cool? Is she lame? Oh, you're talking about what's her name? Pepper Ann. Is she lame? Is she cool? Is she breaking every rule? Is she anybody's fool? Pepper Ann. Pepper Ann. Pepper Ann. Marching in her own parade. Pepper Ann. She's like one in a million. Pepper Ann. Pepper Ann. Much too cool for seventh grade. Catch her if you can. Pepper Ann.
Who? Pepper Ann was the star of the 1997 cartoon on Disney's One Saturday Morning. In the show, Pepper Ann faced moral dilemmas and always ended the episode by learning a valuable lesson. Accompanied by friends Nikki and Milo, they taught viewers that it was okay to be themselves. Most importantly, Pepper Ann had pretty much the best theme song of all time. But the catchy tune we have all come to love was not always what it is now. Here's Maddie and Eddie on that.
That is not the original theme song.
Oh, it's not?
Yeah. There was a theme song before that, and it was just so different. It wasn't happy and upbeat, and we ended up using it in an episode later.
The Milo character is depressed and sings some really depressing song in his bedroom, and it was the original theme song to the show.
Really?
I remember it. Like, so if I could sing it badly, but
I'm sure it's somewhere in the depths of YouTube.
As I remember, the first line was something like,
Is it true,
Pepper Ann? Do you see the same colors I do? And it was like really heavy. Like, it really brought you down.
How,
like,
I wonder.
You're a good singer.
What makes the weather?
Yeah, Maddie can sing.
Too hot, too cold to wear
exactly
shorts,
it,
and too hot for a sweater. Pepper Ann.
But if you.
How different is that?
Wow. So did the theme song get vetoed right away then?
This is before it was vetoed before I think it really went into production, because it was just a little too, I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, other than too
a little
serious.
They wanted something more upbeat and bouncy. And
I think they were going for angst, or the angst of the character.
There's nothing funny about that. You know, it's not, you're not being set up with that theme song to be like, ooh, let's have fun.
Right.
It is very just like, eh.
So do you remember hearing that one, the one we just played for the first time, and thinking, all right, this is it?
Yeah, especially because we had the old one to compare it to.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, this is so much better.
Right. Do you recall the band that did it? Do they still exist? Any idea?
Was it Bambi Moe at the time? Her name was actually Bambi. I think that the voice actress who does Pepper Ann sings the song.
Oh, really? So why do you think it stood the test of time? Why do I still remember that song?
Because you heard it when you were how old?
Eight.
A million times.
Yeah, I guess.
That's everything, I think. Repetition. Yeah. And if you really like that song.
Which I do. I still do.
Or sometimes I can think it works the opposite way, too, where the song you wouldn't have liked if you just heard it as a song on the radio, but if you love the show and associate the song with the show, then suddenly the song seems great to you because of the connection you have to your feelings about the show.
Kim Possible was another popular 90s and 2000s cartoon with a theme song nobody could get out of their head either. Recorded by artist Christina Milian, the Kim Possible theme song had people everywhere changing their ringtones to four distinctive beeps that are recognizable still today.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm your your basic average girl, and I'm here to save the world. You can't stop me cause I'm Kim Possible. There is nothing I can do when danger causes. Know that I am on my way. Call me, beat me, if you wanna reach me. When you wanna face me, it's okay. Whenever you need me, baby.
That one, I mean, equally iconic, I'd say. A little later, you can kind of hear the music trend has changed.
Absolutely.
5 years later when they have more of a hip-hop star. And the ringtone, which plays at the end, let's listen to that.
On the bubble, you know that you always can call Kim Possible.
So what's the sitch?
So how many times have you heard that on people's phones?
Like so many times. And the funny thing is, like for a while when ringtones were first coming up, I'd hear it all the time. Then it seemed to, like, die down, and in the last couple of years, I'd say I now hear it more even. So it's like almost, it feels like, if, I don't know, it's people rediscovering the show or whatever.
Right.
But I will be in a coffee shop, and it's so distinctive. I think I've heard it so many times, I'm programmed to recognize it. So even if it's like way across on the other side of the room, I will hear. I'll kind of perk up like a dog when I hear it. Like
four little notes can be so evocative. Just do do.
Yeah.
Or I remember being in an airport in New Zealand. And hearing it, that we're in, just feeling a little freaked out. It's such a distinctive thing, and it's really brilliant the way they did build it into the title song of the show. And that's, you know, the sound she hears in the show when she gets called. So it's like, that was very, very well put together. And the music on the show in general was really good. but the whole conception of Kim Possible, it came at just the right time. Mark McCorkle and Bob Schooley, who created the show, was sort of their first chance to do an original thing. And I think they really embraced and enjoyed the chance to do their own thing. And I think they kind of were feeling like they were never going to get that chance, so much so that when it came time, this is a true story, the only thought they put into the show before pitching it was, I think Mark McCorkle came up with the name Kim Possible, and Bob Schooley came up with the She Can Do Anything. They put that on a card and went in and just pitched that with no more of an idea of the story or characters than
wow.
That. And that was it.
What?
Very spur of the moment. It wasn't this project that they had been working on for years to try to get off the ground. Like, I think it was a very, very spontaneous thing, and then just grew out of that. But yeah, it was sort of a big, as far as the animation side of things, it was like their big flagship animated show during that time.
Yeah. Pep Rann also aired on something that I remember fondly, One Saturday Morning.
Right.
Which, I mean, exploded, probably. Saturday morning cartoons kind of getting this branding that made everything cohesive. Do you still hear people talk about that as something they remember watching?
No. Never.
No?
Really?
I never hear about One Saturday Morning. It's funny because who watches Saturday morning cartoons anymore?
Right, but we did.
We did too. Yeah. There weren't any other times to watch
it. I hear people talk about the shows from that block, but what you're referring to, the One Saturday Morning, is basically like the interstitial thing that kind of stitched a whole block of...
I remember that jingle too.
I kind of, you know, the funny thing is there was a lot of discussion about those interstitials and how that was, because I think that some of the things they were doing were kind of considered slightly revolutionary, and I think that they were purposely ending and starting shows like 10 minutes past the hour so that if you were watching One Saturday Morning, it would be harder to change to another channel because you'd be
in the middle of the
show. So I think there were things they kind of intentionally planned to do to kind of keep
that block.
It's
not a bad idea, really.
It's actually not. It's actually, from a programming standpoint, it's kind of brilliant. But
probably doesn't matter as much in the DVR age that we're in now.
Absolutely. That's the thing. It was a different era.
Yeah. So does it surprise you, kind of an overall general question, does it surprise you how these things are still prevalent in pop culture, how Kim Possible and Pep Rann specifically are still important in people's lives?
Yeah, I think it really does, because at the time we were making them, you know, you there were shows and then they would just kind of go away. And I think we didn't know at the time was that there was going to be this internet kind of video on demand thing coming that made things not necessarily disappear or fade away, and you can watch them easily, they're readily available, and would be. And so I think that was the thing we didn't see coming, and didn't realize that it's not like people have to watch this live on the air anymore. It's like they can go searching for it online,
right?
And I think that's one of the reasons it's happened. But I remember just, I also remember the first time people started coming up to me who appeared to me to be adults and said, I grew up watching Kim Possible. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a stunning thing, because it kind of, like, to me, it was more of just a wake-up call that I'm older,
that you're older
than Moses, because it just seemed like, well, wait, you're a full-grown person. What do you mean?
Technology has obviously evolved quite a bit since the premiere of Pepper Ann and Kim Possible. Previously, the only way to get a grasp on what viewers thought of a show was to read about it in a review. Now we have tweets, Facebook posts, IMDb, and everything else. But here's what Maddie and Eddie have to say about the evolution of technology and how it's changed the way feedback is received.
When the internet came out. When it became more popular, more vast, I guess.
Sure.
People would, this is so stupid to admit this, but they would, full-grown adults, and they still do this, would post reviews of each episode, right?
Okay.
And that was the only thing you could grab onto. Like, oh God, did that guy like my episode?
Sure.
When it came out, because, this is the problem with cartoons, all TV. You're not sitting there with the audience. They're just,
have no idea.
And cartoons are even more spread out because it takes 9 months to animate them. And by the time that makes air, you forgot you wrote it.
And they're not covered by, it's not like mainstream publications would do reviews of Saturday morning cartoons,
right,
or anything. So there was really no feedback at all. And I think what Maddie's talking about is, like, once the internet started, you were so desperate to hear some reaction to things that you would end up like, you'd be reading somebody's reviews as though it were the New York Times. And then and then kind of realize,
and you'd be sad if they didn't like it.
Yeah. But then also realize that this is like could be a guy in his garage. Like, just a crazy person. Like, and you get the feeling that the largest audience he had were writers from the shows he was reviewing that were searching for some kind of feedback or some validation that they didn't suck.
That's all writers, always.
So do you remember, either of you, a specific episode you wrote? Does it stick with you? And can you remind us what happened in the show?
Yeah, I mean, I can remember, for Kim Possible, there's one, I believe, from season two called Exchange, where the premise is that Ron does some exchange program with a Japanese student, but when he gets there, actually finds out it's some sort of ninja school. It's sort of like a mix-up, and ends up basically being trained as a ninja. So the main thing was just Ron gets to blunder his way through being like a ninja. and it was an episode that I think, like, Mark, Bob, and I loved. And I just remember when writing it was the Disney Channel just hated it.
Really?
I'm not sure exactly why. I think it was because a lot of the humor wasn't really done in jokes. It was more just the situation of Ron, Ron being a ninja. It's almost like the more serious you play that, the funnier it is. And I don't think they saw that as being funny. It would get slammed by notes, and it was just such a struggle to get that episode through. And then it turned out great. I think it was directed by Steve Loader, who directed the Kim Possible movie that came later and stuff. Mm. And it turned out really well. And the funny thing was that was the episode that the Disney Channel submitted. I think the way they do kind of Emmy submissions,
oh,
is they'll submit sort of one episode as, like, this is to the representative of the show. And that was the episode I think they submitted for the Emmy that year, which was always ironic to me because my memories were sitting in meetings and them just batting the script up and down. So that's the one that stands out to me from Kim Possible. Another one, I think I did the episode Day of the Snowman, which is one where the snowmen in town come to life and are basically kind of zombies. So it's like a siege in Kim Possible's house where it's snowmen getting in, zombie kind of style. And I remember that was an interesting episode too, because I think it played very much like a horror movie, but I think in our minds it was funny because they were snowmen. But it also worked because snowmen are kind of creepy. But I think even that got weird. Like, we could do a whole show on the standards and practices notes we got during that time period, because that really was at the height of sort of political correctness, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, where it was really kind of gaining ground. And so I think for that episode, we were actually struggled with getting the note that they can't be called snowmen. We have to call these, they're snow, it's a snow,
no.
It's a snow person.
Wow.
which, you know, it was kind of mind-boggling. But like it's at that time in particular, like you couldn't just laugh it off. Like you would have to kind of email and then have meetings explaining your position, why, while trying to keep a straight face and not just laugh in these people's like faces.
Audience members fell in love with Rufus, the quirky naked mole rat, so quickly that he became a staple character in Kim Possible. Here's Eddie on the development of Rufus.
I don't think I was in a lot. I was not in a lot of those like early development meetings for it. So it's possible that there were fights made there. But I think that it's also funny how I think at it, they because it was one of the first Disney Channel shows, they did a lot of like market testing research groups. And I think they were not crazy about the naked mole, mostly because they thought it wasn't cute enough or whatever. It wasn't fluffy and cute. Like,
right.
But I think once they started market testing it, that Rufus character tested so much through the roof that then I think they didn't care. Yeah, bring the naked mole rat. I think they were even demanding like more episodes that are like Rufus-centric like episodes. So they were all about the naked mole rat once it tested off the charts to kids.
Again, we're talking about the shows Pepper Ann and Kim Possible, Maddie and Eddie in studio, talking about the shows that they wrote way back when. And then how about just like some commentary on where TV has gone? You know, do people my age, you think, remember these shows so fondly because they were better than shows are today? Or is it just like a byproduct of that generation?
How could we possibly answer that?
It's a good question. It's a good question. I don't know. I don't know whether there is part of it that I think every generation feels like the shows they grew up with were a little better because they were special to you and stuff. But I don't know that if shows are better or worse. They do seem like they're a little different in that, like, for example, Pepper Ann, who was created by Sue Rose, it felt like a very like personal vision of like what she remembered her childhood to be like.
It kind of is her.
It was the
first woman to create a show for Disney Channel, I think I read her. She was like the first woman created show.
Probably the first woman that I can think of, definitely. But it was a very personal kind of thing. And I get the feeling that is definitely gone now. The shows that come out now are very much more by committee kind of things. And that a show like that would not, you know, that person would have to make it as their own web series or something, because to get it on kind of a major network, I think something that's that small and personal is not, you know, doesn't tick the boxes.
The 90s weren't particularly iconic for fashion or for music, but for people of a certain age, it was definitely memorable. Maddie and Eddie share with me the trends they were sporting at that time.
I didn't realize we would be exposed like this. I mean, this is the thing.
We were probably your age.
Right.
And to our, in our minds, we're still your age. So
yeah, in our deluded,
so we know
in our,
exact same you were
in our deluded minds.
No, that's kind of, it's like time passes and you don't exactly feel it passing, like things changing the way you do from childhood to adulthood.
Sure.
Because me for the 90s, I suspect it's probably the same for Maddie, is that was sort of the time I finished college and moved to LA. So it was my first foray into kind of Hollywood and the entertainment business was, I think, 92 I moved here. And so my memory of myself then is being sort of struggling, you know, working in mail rooms and struggling to kind of break into the industry somehow. And so I think I was wearing very little. I'm trying to think of like, is there anything, was there any really embarrassing cargo pants?
I think I would
definitely be guilty of that. This is the beauty of it, though, is that that era was still pre-digital camera. So whatever I was wearing, it's still going to be kind of a secret. Like we can wipe that from the record. since digital cameras came along and phones and stuff, like people growing up now, like anytime, like if you were to ask that question to somebody in, you know, 10 years, 15 years from now, you'll just be able to pull up online
on Facebook
and find out exactly what they were wearing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like I'm very happy that I can't go back and see what I was wearing when I was working in a mailroom in 1994.
I can remember what I was wearing in the 80s more because it was very more dramatic.
It's pretty
and
distinctive, yeah.
Whereas I don't know if I could tell that much of a difference between the last three decades. I don't know. Maybe that's because I'm getting older.
This is not exactly the same thing. What were you driving? That for people who moved to LA, that's always a big question.
Sure.
It's like you can't be in LA without a car and you don't have any money and stuff. So I was in some just awful, like 1983 Volkswagen Scirocco.
That's what you were wearing.
This is the model that, it, like, and you don't even see them on the streets anymore. It's not like they've stood the test of time, or like I don't remember the last time I've passed a Scirocco on the street. And Maddie, what were you?
I was
cruising?
Driving a Ford Tempo.
Yeah, also not a thing anymore.
I'm trying to think, like, the 90s, even like the music and things.
Yeah,
but
what were we listening to in
the
90s?
Well, it was the grunge thing.
Sure.
Came along.
Nirvana.
That was a big
Did
thing.
Did No Doubt come along?
Yeah, No Doubt. Yeah. Definitely.
Well, here's the thing. Yeah. The show that I'm working on now.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's a Gwen Stefani show.
Oh, yeah. It's a Gwen Stefani show?
Yeah, see, I forgot.
Cartoon.
We should have started with this, because I forgot that she was sort of a 90s icon.
Yeah, she's also an Orange County resident, by the way.
Yeah, that's true, too. So, yeah. Your listeners.
Yeah.
So we, although she doesn't live there now, because we've been to her house.
I like you can drop that in.
Yeah, sure. No,
when I was
at
Gwen's house.
Post No Doubt, she did this Harajuku Girls thing. And a lot of merchandising came out of that, and including little action, not action figures, but little designs of her and these girls. And basically, they hired me to come up with a show around that.
Okay.
So I did. Now we're moving into season 3 on this show, but this is in Australia.
Oh.
So when the internet came out, the good thing about it is now I don't have to go anywhere to work. I can stay here. So yeah, basically
right.
That's...
So we haven't seen this show in the United States.
And I don't know if you ever will. I mean, they're trying to get it to air on Disney, on something on Disney. So let's see if that
So
ever
you
happens.
Maybe were listening to No Doubt in the 90s. Fast forward a couple decades, and now you're hanging out with Gwen on her new
really
show.
It's really strange.
And I wouldn't say hanging out with her.
No, we don't hang out with her. We've just gone to her house.
But she's been great about the show, you know, as far as like, you know, approving things and stuff. She seems... One really great.
These days, Maddie and Eddie have done a real 180 in their careers. They don't make cartoons, but rather horror films. They have an independent film out now called Blood Punch.
It is an adult horror film, not a children's.
No.
That's what happens when good cartoon writers go bad.
That could be another show.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Blood Punch was something we did. It did feel like, in a lot of ways, we did it to get it out of our system. There were some pent up issues, maybe from writing Winnie the Pooh things for long enough. Or,
but you learn a lot from writing cartoons because it's not like live action stuff where cartoons have to have each character has to have a very distinctive character. You can't just boy, girl, you know, they have to have a personality, a real personality to. It's a cartoon, right?
I think in live action, there is a tendency to sometimes you can get away with writing characters bland, and you're counting on the actor to bring something that's going to make it come to life. And I think in animation, it's almost the opposite philosophy of you can't assume that, you know, like the limits of the visual thing. You don't know what you're going to get back. You don't know who's going to be cast in it. And I think it sort of trains you in a better way to make the voice of each character on the page as you're writing very distinctive and to pop.
Working at Disney in the early 90s and 2000s, one could imagine, probably had its perks. Eddie shares a great story here about how he got his hands on a copy of a legendary film.
I will tell a version of the story without names.
Would you get sued or something?
No. It's just that just by chance, we had heard about the movie Toy Story before, but we were not working in feature animation, so it didn't have a lot of directing. Plus, it was like a Pixar thing, so it was not specifically a Disney thing. It was not something that Disney people were that aware of or knew much about. But I got a chance to get a hold of a storyboard version of the movie, and this is probably close to a year before it came out, maybe even longer, where it was just rough pencil drawings and the voices. And it was sort of like, strung together, edited together really roughly with the voices.
With a little touch of the actual 3D.
I think there were just a couple just shots that were sort of test shots of what was going to be the 3D thing. But you didn't even really get a sense of how good it was going to
be. Was it the actual actors?
Yes. It was the actual voices. I don't know if they were the final recording or if they re-recorded some of it. It may have been a scratch track, but it was definitely the main actors. And it's a long story, but the trick was I could only get my hands on this for like a 2 hour period, and then it had to go back to where it was supposed to be.
And this is a VHS tape.
Yeah, this is before things.
That's what we
had. And so we had basically a secret screening of the movie at Television Animation, where Mark McCorkle and Bob Schooley attended. Like, it was a group of kind of our friends. And I just remember, you know, at this point, you knew nothing about this movie. If anything, it was considered that the weird computer thing that was being done. And we watched it and just were blown away by how good it was. Like couldn't believe how even in just rough pencil things that weren't animated, the story came through, the characters came through.
Everything.
And it was just, we were just like, this is going to be a huge movie. It's so good.
Then we couldn't tell anybody.
Right. Well, yes. Yeah, so, and not that long after that, a couple of months after that, I happened to be in a meeting, because this is the other thing, that Disney was a lot smaller back then. So I was a lowly whatever, but there were only like two people between me and Michael Eisner, like the head of the company. And so I would find myself in meetings where I would just be in meetings with Michael Eisner, like kind of big meetings with Michael Eisner and these huge meetings I really had no business being in. And this was, I think, soon after Mike Ovitz had joined the Disney company, and they had a big meeting to go through kind of the upcoming things that were coming out, which I think included The Hunchback of Notre Dame was their big feature. And I remember at some point them being like, yeah, and then we got Toy Story, but, you know, I think that's going to be just like a kind of a modest little thing. Like, they were so dismissive of it. And at that point, there was no way I could explain how I had seen the movie.
Right.
So, but it was like I had to really stop myself from being like, no, don't you see? That's something incredibly special. Like, and I think the funny thing is that was the meeting where they sort of decided to scale back the merchandising on the Toy Story thing, which became such a thing that they actually made fun of that in Toy Story 2.
Yeah,
there's a line in Toy Story 2 about how like
kind
of
expect the toys.
Yeah, they didn't make much merchandise, and that's a direct reference to the fact that Toy Story 1, they didn't nearly anticipate how big it was going to be.
Yeah,
and it was funny to have been in the meeting where you saw that happen, and even at the time knew that was like a huge mistake.
Wow,
and stuff. So we got to witness a lot of cool stuff by just being at Disney during that time.
That's cool. I mean, you guys were on the inside of you know, one of the biggest animated movies of all time.
Well, on the inside,
many others,
but not really involved. I mean, as a complete observer, as an observer, yes.
Witnesses that couldn't say a word.
A benevolent observer and admirer of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you guys sharing so many intimate details of your past and of the shows Kim Possible and Pepper Ann. Saved by the 90s will air every week, dedicated to 90s and millennial nostalgia. Sounds like it's still very much alive in your guys' lives, as it is with many of us. So thanks for sharing with
us. Absolutely. No, thank you
for
having us. It's great.
Great being here.
Yeah. Thanks to you both. Madeline Paxson, Eddie Guzalian. We'll see you guys soon.
Take care.
This has been Saved by the 90s. Thanks for remembering a simpler decade with us. I'm Tyler Russell, interviewing and booking done by me. Production of this episode done by Emmy Liu. And on next week's show, I'm really excited to talk to two original members of the band Sugar Ray. Yes, Fly Every Morning, that Sugar Ray. New episodes every other